Chapter 11. The Pit of Plenty. I did not languish long within the prison of Silenciosal. During the short time that I lay there, fettered with chains of gold, I often wondered as to the fate of Thuvan Din, Jeddak of Darth. My brave companion had followed me into the garden as I attacked Thurid, and when Silenciosal had left with Dejathoris and the others, leaving Thuvia of Darth behind, he too had remained in the garden with his daughter, apparently unnoticed, for he was apparelled similarly to the guards. The last I had seen of him, he stood waiting for the warriors who escorted me to close the gate behind them, that he might be alone with Thuvia. Could it be possible that they had escaped? I doubted it, and yet with all my heart I hoped that it might be true. The third day of my incarceration brought a dozen warriors to escort me to the audience chamber, where Silenciosal himself was to try me. A great number of nobles crowded the room, and among them I saw Thurid, but Mada Aishan was not there. Dejathoris, as radiantly beautiful as ever, sat upon a small throne beside Silenciosal. The expression of sad hopelessness upon her dear face cut deep into my heart. Her position beside the Jeddak of Jeddaks boded ill for her and me, and on the instant that I saw her there sprang to my mind the firm intention never to leave that chamber alive, if I must leave her in the clutches of this powerful tyrant. I had killed better men than Silenciosal, and killed them with my bare hands, and now I swore to myself that I should kill him if I found that the only way to save the Princess of Helium, that it would mean almost instant death for me I cared not, except that it would remove me from further efforts in behalf of Dejathoris, and for this reason alone I would have chosen another way, for even though I should kill Silenciosal, that act would not restore my beloved wife to her own people. I determined to wait the final outcome of the trial, that I might learn all that I could of the Icarian ruler's intentions, and then act accordingly. Scarcely had I come before him than Silenciosal summoned Thurid also. "Dater Thurid," he said, "you have made a strange request of me, but, in accordance with your wishes and your promise, that it will result only to my interests, I have decided to accede. You tell me that a certain announcement will be the means of convicting this prisoner, and, at the same time, open the way to the gratification of my dearest wish." Thurid nodded. "Then shall I make the announcement here before all my nobles," continued Silenciosal. "For a year no queen has sat upon the throne beside me, and now it suits me to take to wife one who is reputed the most beautiful woman upon Barsoom. A statement which none may truthfully deny. Nobles of Ochre, unsheathe your swords, and do homage to Dejathoris, Princess of Helium and future Queen of Ochre, for at the end of the allotted 10 days she shall become the wife of Silenciosal." As the nobles drew their blades, and lifted them on high, in accordance with the ancient custom of Ochre, when a Jeddak announces his intention to wed, Dejathoris sprang to her feet, and, raising her hand aloft, cried in a loud voice that they desist. "I may not be the wife of Silenciosal," she pleaded, "for already I be a wife and mother. John Carter, Prince of Helium, still lives. I know it to be true, for I overheard Mada Aishan tell his daughter Fader that he had seen him in Kaer, at the court of Kulan Tith, Jeddak. A Jeddak does not wed a married woman, nor will Silenciosal thus violate the bonds of matrimony." Silenciosal turned upon Thurid with an ugly look. "Is this the surprise you held in store for me?" he cried. "Who assured me that no obstacle which might not be easily overcome stood between me and this woman, and now I find that the one insuperable obstacle intervenes? What mean you, man? What have you to say? And should I deliver John Carter into your hands, Silenciosal, would you not feel that I had more than satisfied the promise that I made you?" answered Thurid. "Talk not like a fool," cried the enraged Jeddak. "I'm no child to be thus played with." "I am talking only as a man who knows," replied Thurid. "Knows that he can do all that he claims. Then turn John Carter over to me within 10 days or yourself suffer the end that I should mete out to him were he in my power," snapped the Jeddak of Jeddaks, with an ugly scowl. "You need not wait 10 days, Silenciosal," replied Thurid. "And then, Turning suddenly upon me as he extended a pointing finger, he cried, "Here stands John Carter, Prince of Helium."
"Fool!"
shrieked Salensasal. "Fool! John Carter is a white man. This fellow be as yellow as myself." John Carter's face is smooth. Mada Ishan has described him to me. This prisoner has a beard and mustache as large and black as any ochre. "Quick, guardsmen, to the pits with the black maniac who wishes to throw his life away for a poor joke upon your ruler."
"Hold!"
cried Thurid, and springing forward, before I could guess his intention, he had grasped my beard and ripped the whole false fabric from my face and head, revealing my smooth, tanned skin beneath and my close-cropped black hair. Instantly pandemonium reigned in the audience chamber of Salensasal. Warriors pressed forward with drawn blades, thinking that I might be contemplating the assassination of the Jeddak of Jeddaks, while others, out of curiosity to see one whose name was familiar from pole to pole, crowded behind their fellows. As my identity was revealed, I saw Deja Thoris spring to her feet, amazement writ large upon her face, and then through that jam of armed men she forced her way before any could prevent. A moment only, and she was before me with outstretched arms and eyes filled with the light of her great love. "John Carter! John Carter!" she cried as I folded her to my breast, and then of a sudden I knew why he had denied me in the garden beneath the tower. What a fool I had been! Expecting that she would penetrate the marvelous disguise that had been wrought for me by the barber of Merentina. As he had not known me, that was all, and when she saw the sign of love from a stranger she was offended and righteously indignant. "Indeed, but I had been a fool. And it was you," she cried, "who spoke to me from the tower. How could I dream that my beloved Virginian lay behind that fierce beard and that yellow skin?" As he had been wont to call me her Virginian as a term of endearment, for she knew that I loved the sound of that beautiful name, made a thousand times more beautiful and hallowed by her dear lips, and as I heard it again after all those long years my eyes became dimmed with tears, and my voice choked with emotion. But an instant did I crush that dear form to me ere Salensasal, trembling with rage and jealousy, shouldered his way to us. "Seize the man," he cried to his warriors, and 100 ruthless hands tore us apart. Well, it was for the nobles of the court of Ochre that John Carter had been disarmed. As it was, 12 of them felt the weight of my clenched fists, and I had fought my way half up the steps before the throne to which Salensasal had carried Deja Thoris ere ever they could stop me. Then I went down, fighting, beneath 100 warriors. But before they had battered me into unconsciousness I heard that from the lips of Deja Thoris, that made all my suffering well worthwhile. Standing there beside the great tyrant, who clutched her by the arm, she pointed to where I fought alone against such awful odds. "Think you, Salensasal, that the wife of such as he is," she cried, "would ever dishonor his memory, were he 1,000 times dead, by mating with a lesser mortal? Lives there upon any world such another as John Carter, Prince of Helium? Lives there another man who could fight his way back and forth across a warlike planet, facing savage beasts and hordes of savage men, for the love of a woman? I, Deja Thoris, Princess of Helium, am his. He fought for me and won me. If you be a brave man you will honor the bravery that is his, and you will not kill him. Make him a slave if you will, Salensasal, but spare his life. I would rather be a slave with such as he, than be Queen of Ochre." "Neither slave nor queen dictates to Salensasal," replied the Jeddak of Jeddaks. "Own Carter shall die a natural death in the pit of plenty, and the day he dies Deja Thoris shall become my queen." I did not hear her reply, for it was then that a blow upon my head brought unconsciousness, and when I recovered my senses only a handful of guardsmen remained in the audience chamber with me. As I opened my eyes they goaded me with the points of their swords, and bade me rise. Then they led me through long corridors to a court far toward the center of the palace. In the center of the court was a deep pit, near the edge of which stood 6 other guardsmen, awaiting me. One of them carried a long rope in his hands, which he commenced to make ready as we approached. We had come to within 50 feet of these men, when I felt a sudden strange and rapid pricking sensation in one of my fingers. For a moment I was nonplussed by the odd feeling, and then there came to me recollection of that which in the stress of my adventure I had entirely forgotten, the gift ring of Prince Talu of Merentina. Instantly I looked toward the group we were nearing, at the same time raising my left hand to my forehead, that the ring might be visible to one who sought it. Simultaneously one of the waiting warriors raised his left hand, ostensibly to brush back his hair, and upon one of his fingers I saw the duplicate of my own ring. A quick look of intelligence passed between us, after which I kept my eyes turned away from the warrior, and did not look at him again, for fear that I might arouse the suspicion of the Icarians. When we reached the edge of the pit I saw that it was very deep, and presently I realized I was soon to judge just how far it extended below the surface of the court, for he who held the rope passed it about my body in such a way that it could be released from above at any time. And then, as all the warriors grasped it, he pushed me forward, and I fell into the yawning abyss. After the first jerk as I reached the end of the rope that had been paid out to let me fall below the pit's edge, they lowered me quickly but smoothly. The moment before the plunge, while two or three of the men had been assisting in adjusting the rope about me, one of them had brought his mouth close to my cheek, and in the brief interval before I was cast into the forbidding hole, he breathed a single word into my ear. Courage! The pit, which my imagination had pictured as bottomless, proved to be not more than 100 feet in depth. But as its walls were smoothly polished, it might as well have been 1,000 feet, for I could never hope to escape without outside assistance. For a day I was left in darkness, and then, quite suddenly, a brilliant light illumined my strange cell. I was reasonably hungry and thirsty by this time, not having tasted food or drink since the day prior to my incarceration. To my amazement, I found the sides of the pit, that I had thought smooth, lined with shelves, upon which were the most delicious viands and liquid refreshments that ochre afforded. With an exclamation of delight, I sprang forward to partake of some of the welcome food, but ere ever I reached it, the light was extinguished, and, though I groped my way about the chamber, my hands came in contact with nothing besides the smooth hard wall that I had felt on my first examination of my prison. Immediately the pangs of hunger and thirst began to assail me. Where before I had had but a mild craving for food and drink, I now actually suffered for want of it, and all because of the tantalizing sight that I had had of food almost within my grasp. Once more darkness and silence enveloped me, a silence that was broken only by a single mocking laugh. For another day nothing occurred to break the monotony of my imprisonment, or relieve the suffering superinduced by hunger and thirst. Slowly the pangs became less keen, as suffering deadened the activity of certain nerves, and then the light flashed on once again, and before me stood an array of new and tempting dishes, with great bottles of clear water and flagons of refreshing wine, upon the outside of which the cold sweat of condensation stood. Again, with the hunger madness of a wild beast, I sprang forward to seize those tempting dishes. But, as before, the light went out, and I came to a sudden stop against a hard wall. Then the mocking laugh rang out for a second time. The pit of plenty. Ah, what a cruel mind must have devised this exquisite, hellish torture. Day after day was the thing repeated, until I was on the verge of madness. And then, as I had done in the pits of the Warhoons, I took a new, firm hold upon my reason, and forced it back into the channels of sanity. By sheer willpower I regained control over my tottering mentality, and so successful was I, that the next time that the light came I sat quite still, and looked indifferently at the fresh and tempting food almost within my reach. Glad I was that I had done so, for it gave me an opportunity to solve the seeming mystery of those vanishing banquets. As I made no move to reach the food, the torturers left the light turned on in the hope that at last I could refrain no longer from giving them the delicious thrill of enjoyment that my former futile efforts to obtain it had caused. And as I sat scrutinizing the laden shelves, I presently saw how the thing was accomplished, and so simple was it that I wondered I had not guessed it before. The wall of my prison was of clearest glass. Behind the glass were the tantalizing vines. After nearly an hour the light went out, but this time there was no mocking laughter, at least, not upon the part of my tormentors. But I, to be at quits with them, gave a low laugh that none might mistake for the cackle of a maniac. 9 days passed, and I was weak from hunger and thirst, but no longer suffering I was past that. Then, down through the darkness above, a little parcel fell to the floor at my side. Indifferently I groped for it, thinking it but some new invention of my jailer's, to add to my sufferings. At last I found it a tiny package wrapped in paper, at the end of a strong and slender cord. As I opened it a few lozenges fell to the floor. As I gathered them up, feeling of them, and smelling of them, I discovered that they were tablets of concentrated food such as are quite common in all parts of Barsoom. Poison. I thought, well, what of it? Why not end my misery now, rather than drag out a few more wretched days in this dark pit? Slowly I raised one of the little pellets to my lips. Goodbye, my Degithoris, I breathed. Have lived for you and fought for you, and now my next dearest wish is to be realized, for I shall die for you, and, taking the morsel in my mouth, I devoured it. One by one I ate them all, nor ever did anything taste better than those tiny bits of nourishment, within which I knew, must lie the seeds of death, possibly of some hideous, torturing death. As I sat quietly upon the floor of my prison, waiting for the end, my fingers by accident came in contact with the bit of paper in which the things had been wrapped, and as I idly played with it, my mind roaming far back into the past, that I might live again for a few brief moments, before I died some of the many happy moments of a long and happy life, I became aware of strange protuberances upon the smooth surface of the parchment-like substance in my hands. For a time they carried no special significance to my mind. I merely was mildly wondrous that they were there, but at last they seemed to take form, and then I realized that there was but a single line of them, like writing. Now, more interestedly, my fingers traced and retraced them. There were four separate and distinct combinations of raised lines. Could it be that these were four words, and that they were intended to carry a message to me? The more I thought of it, the more excited I became, until my fingers raced madly back and forth over those bewildering little hills and valleys upon that bit of paper. But I could make nothing of them, and at last I decided that my very haste was preventing me from solving the mystery. Then I took it more slowly. Again and again my forefinger traced the first of those four combinations. Martian writing is rather difficult to explain to an Earthman. It is something of a cross between shorthand and picture writing, and is an entirely different language from the spoken language of Mars. Upon Barsoom there is but a single oral language. It is spoken today by every race and nation, just as it was at the beginning of human life upon Barsoom. It has grown with the growth of the planet's learning and scientific achievements, but so ingenious a thing it is that new words to express new thoughts, or describe new conditions or discoveries form themselves. No other word could explain the thing that a new word is required for other than the word that naturally falls to it, and so, no matter how far removed two nations or races, their spoken languages are identical. Not so their written languages, however. No two nations have the same written language, and often cities of the same nation have a written language that differs greatly from that of the nation to which they belong. Thus it was that the signs upon the paper, if in reality they were words, baffled me for some time, but at last I made out the first one. It was Urich, and it was written in the letters of Merentina. Courage. That was the word the yellow guardsman had whispered in my ear as I stood upon the verge of the pit of plenty. The message must be from him, and he I knew was a friend. With renewed hope I bent my every energy to the deciphering of the balance of the message, and at last success rewarded my endeavor. I had read the four words. Courage. Follow the rope. Follow the rope. What could it mean? Follow the rope. What rope? Presently I recalled the cord that had been attached to the parcel when it fell at my side, and after a little groping my hand came in contact with it again. It depended from above, and when I pulled upon it, I discovered that it was rigidly fastened, possibly at the pit's mouth. Upon examination, I found that the cord, though small, was amply able to sustain the weight of several men. Then I made another discovery. There was a second message knotted in the rope at about the height of my head. This I deciphered more easily, now that the key was mine. Bring the rope with you. Beyond the knots lies danger. That was all there was to this message. It was evidently hastily formed an afterthought. I did not pause longer than to learn the contents of the second message, and, though I was none too sure of the meaning of the final admonition, beyond the knots lies danger, yet I was sure that here before me lay an avenue of escape, and that the sooner I took advantage of it the more likely was I to win to liberty. At least, I could be but little worse off than I had been in the pit of plenty. I was to find, however, ere I was well out of that damnable hole, that I might have been very much worse off had I been compelled to remain there another 2 minutes. It had taken me about that length of time to ascend some 50 feet above the bottom, when a noise above attracted my attention. To my chagrin, I saw that the covering of the pit was being removed far above me, and in the light of the courtyard beyond I saw a number of yellow warriors. Could it be that I was laboriously working my way into some new trap? Were the messages spurious, after all? And then, just as my hope and courage had ebbed to their lowest, I saw two things. One was the body of a huge, struggling, snarling apt being lowered over the side of the pit toward me, and the other was an aperture in the side of the shaft, an aperture larger than a man's body, into which my rope led. Just as I scrambled into the dark hole before me, he yapped past me, reaching out with his mighty hands to clutch me, and snapping, growling, and roaring in a most frightful manner. Plainly now I saw the end for which Silenus Sala destined me. After first torturing me with starvation, he had caused this fierce beast to be lowered into my prison to finish the work that the jeddak's hellish imagination had conceived. And then another truth flashed upon me. I had lived 9 days of the allotted 10 which must intervene before Silenus Sala could make Dejithoris his queen. The purpose of the act was to ensure my death before the 10th day. I almost laughed aloud as I thought how Silenus Sala's measure of safety was to aid in defeating the very end he sought, for when they discovered that the apt was alone in the pit of plenty, they could not know but that he had completely devoured me, and so no suspicion of my escape would cause a search to be made for me. Coiling the rope that had carried me thus far upon my strange journey, I sought for the other end, but found that as I followed it forward it extended always before me. So this was the meaning of the words, "Allo the rope." The tunnel through which I crawled was low and dark. I had followed it for several hundred yards when I felt a knot beneath my fingers. Beyond the knots lies danger. Now I went with the utmost caution, and a moment later a sharp turn in the tunnel brought me to an opening into a large, brilliantly lighted chamber. The trend of the tunnel I had been traversing had been slightly upward, and from this, I judged that the chamber into which I now found myself looking must be either on the first floor of the palace, or directly beneath the first floor. Upon the opposite wall were many strange instruments and devices, and in the center of the room stood a long table, at which two men were seated in earnest conversation. He who faced me was a yellow man, a little wizened up, pasty-faced old fellow with great eyes that showed the white round the entire circumference of the iris. His companion was a black man, and I did not need to see his face to know that it was Thurid, for there was no other of the firstborn north of the ice barrier. Thurid was speaking as I came within hearing of the men's voices. "Solon," he was saying, "there is no risk and the reward is great. You know that you hate Silenus Sala, and that nothing would please you more than to thwart him in some cherished plan. There be nothing that he more cherishes today than the idea of wedding the beautiful princess of Helium, but I too want her, and with your help I may win her. You need not more than step from this room for an instant when I give you the signal. I will do the rest, and then, when I am gone, you may come and throw the great switch back into its place, and all will be as before. I need but an hour's start to be safe beyond the devilish power that you control in this hidden chamber beneath the palace of your master. See how easy, and with the words the black dater rose from his seat, and, crossing the room, laid his hand upon a large, burnished lever that protruded from the opposite wall. No! No! Cried the little old man, springing after him, with a wild shriek. Not that one! Not that one! That controls the sunray tanks, and should you pull it too far down, all Kadabra would be consumed by heat, before I could replace it. Come away! Come away! You know not with what mighty powers you play. This is the lever that you seek. Note well the symbol inlet in white upon its even surface. Thurid approached and examined the handle of the lever. Ah, a magnet, he said. We'll remember. It is settled then, I take it, he continued. The old man hesitated. A look of combined greed and apprehension overspread his none too beautiful features. Double the figure, he said. Then that were all too small an amount for the service you ask. Why, I risk my life by even entertaining you here within the forbidden precincts of my station. Should Silensis all learn of it, he would have me thrown to the apse before the day was done. He dare not do that, and you know it full well, Solon, contradicted the black. Who great a power of life and death you hold over the people of Kadabra for Silensis all ever, to risk threatening you with death. Before ever his minions could lay their hands upon you, you might seize this very lever from which you have just warned me, and wipe out the entire city. And myself into the bargain, said Solon, with a shudder. But if you were to die, anyway, you would find the nerve to do it, replied Thurid. Yes, muttered Solon, I have often thought upon that very thing. Well, firstborn, is your red princess worth the price I ask for my services, or will you go without her, and see her in the arms of Silensis all tomorrow night? Take your price, yellow man, replied Thurid, with an oath. Elf now and the balance, when you have fulfilled your contract. With that the dater threw a well-filled money pouch upon the table. Solon opened the pouch, and with trembling fingers counted its contents. His weird eyes assumed a greedy expression, and his unkempt beard and mustache twitched with the muscles of his mouth and chin. It was quite evident from his very mannerism that Thurid had keenly guessed the man's weakness. Even the claw-like, clutching movement of the fingers betokened the avariciousness of the miser. Having satisfied himself that the amount was correct, Solon replaced the money in the pouch and rose from the table. Now, he said, are you quite sure that you know the way to your destination? You must travel quickly to cover the ground to the cave, and from thence beyond the great power, all within a brief hour, for no more dare I spare you. Let me repeat it to you, said Thurid, that you may see if I be letter perfect. Proceed, replied Solon. Through yonder door, he commenced, pointing to a door at the far end of the apartment, I follow a corridor, passing three diverging corridors upon my right, then into the fourth right-hand corridor straight to where three corridors meet. Here again I follow to the right, hugging the left wall closely to avoid the pit. At the end of this corridor I shall come to a spiral runway, which I must follow down instead of up. After that the way is long, but a single branchless corridor. Am I right? Quite right, Dater, answered Solon. And now begin. Already have you tempted fate too long within this forbidden place. Tonight, or tomorrow, then, you may expect the signal, said Thurid, rising to go. Tonight, or tomorrow, repeated Solon, and as the door closed behind his guest the old man continued to mutter as he turned back to the table, where he again dumped the contents of the money pouch, running his fingers through the heap of shining metal, piling the coins in two little towers, counting, recounting, and fondling the wealth the while he muttered on and on in a crooning undertone. Presently his fingers ceased their play. His eyes popped wider than ever as they fastened upon the door through which Thurid had disappeared. The croon changed to a querulous muttering, and finally to an ugly growl. Then the old man rose from the table, shaking his fist at the closed door. Now he raised his voice, and his words came distinctly. Fool, he muttered. Think you that for your happiness Solon will give up his life? If you escaped, Silenus all would know that only through my connivance could you have succeeded. Then would he send for me? What would you have me do? Reduce the city and myself to ashes? No, fool, there is a better way for Solon to keep thy money and be revenged upon Silenus all. He laughed in a nasty, cackling note. Poor fool. You may throw the great switch that will give you the freedom of the heir of Ochre, and then, in fatuous security, go on with thy red princess to the freedom of death. When you have passed beyond this chamber in your flight, what can prevent Solon replacing the switch as it was before your vile hand touched it? Nothing, and then the Guardian of the North will claim you and your woman, and Silenus all, when he sees your dead bodies, will never dream that the hand of Solon had aught to do with the thing. Then his voice dropped once more into mutterings that I could not translate, but I had heard enough to cause me to guess a great deal more, and I thanked the kind providence that had led me to this chamber at a time so filled with importance to Dejithoris and myself as this. But how to pass the old man now? The cord, almost invisible upon the floor, stretched straight across the apartment to a door upon the far side. There was no other way of which I knew, nor could I afford to ignore the advice to follow the rope. I must cross this room, but however I should accomplish it undetected with that old man in the very center of it baffled me. Of course I might have sprung in upon him, and with my bare hand silenced him forever, but I had heard enough to convince me that with him alive the knowledge that I had gained might serve me at some future moment. While should I kill him, and another be stationed in his place, Thurid would not come hither with Dejithoris, as was quite evidently his intention. As I stood in the dark shadow of the tunnel's end racking my brain for a feasible plan the while I watched, cat-like, the old man's every move, he took up the money pouch and crossed to one end of the apartment, where, bending to his knees, he fumbled with a panel in the wall. Instantly I guessed that here was the hiding place in which he hoarded his wealth, and while he bent there, his back toward me, I entered the chamber upon tiptoe, and with the utmost stealth essayed to reach the opposite side, before he should complete his task and turn again toward the room's center. Scarcely 30 steps, all told, must I take, and yet it seemed to my overwrought imagination that that farther wall was miles away, but at last I reached it, nor once had I taken my eyes from the back of the old miser's head. He did not turn until my H, and was upon the button that controlled the door through which my way led, and then he turned away from me as I passed through and gently closed the door. For an instant I paused, my ear close to the panel, to learn if he had suspected aught, but as no sound of pursuit came from within I wheeled and made my way along the new corridor, following the rope, which I coiled and brought with me as I advanced. But a short distance farther on I came to the rope's end at a point where 5 corridors met. What was I to do? Which way should I turn? I was nonplussed. A careful examination of the end of the rope revealed the fact that it had been cleanly cut with some sharp instrument. This fact and the words that had cautioned me that danger lay beyond the knots convinced me that the rope had been severed since my friend had placed it as my guide, for I had but passed a single knot, whereas there had evidently been 2 or more in the entire length of the cord. Now, indeed, was I in a pretty fix, for neither did I know which avenue to follow nor when danger lay directly in my path. But there was nothing else to be done than follow one of the corridors, for I could gain nothing by remaining where I was. So I chose the central opening, and passed on into its gloomy depths with a prayer upon my lips. The floor of the tunnel rose rapidly as I advanced, and a moment later the way came to an abrupt end before a heavy door. I could hear nothing beyond, and, with my accustomed rashness, pushed the portal wide to step into a room filled with yellow warriors. The first to see me opened his eyes wide in astonishment, and at the same instant I felt the tingling sensation in my finger that denoted the presence of a friend of the ring. Then others saw me, and there was a concerted rush to lay hands upon me, for these were all members of the palace guard, men familiar with my face. The first to reach me was the wearer of the mate to my strange ring, and as he came close he whispered, "Erendur to me." Then in a loud voice shouted, "Who are my prisoner, white man?" and menaced me with his two weapons. And so John Carter, Prince of Helium, meekly surrendered to a single antagonist. The others now swarmed about us, asking many questions, but I would not talk to them, and finally my captor announced that he would lead me back to my cell. An officer ordered several other warriors to accompany him, and a moment later we were retracing the way I had just come. My friend walked close beside me, asking many silly questions about the country from which I had come, until finally his fellows paid no further attention to him or his gabbling. Gradually, as he spoke, he lowered his voice, so that presently he was able to converse with me in a low tone without attracting attention. His ruse was a clever one, and showed that Talu had not misjudged the man's fitness for the dangerous duty upon which he was detailed. When he had fully assured himself that the other guardsmen were not listening, he asked me why I had not followed the rope, and when I told him that it had ended at the five corridors, he said that it must have been cut by someone in need of a piece of rope, for he was sure that the stupid Catabrans would never have guessed its purpose. Before we had reached the spot from which the five corridors diverged, my Merentinian friend had managed to drop to the rear of the little column with me, and when we came in sight of the branching ways, he whispered, "Run up the first upon the right. It leads to the watchtower upon the south wall. I will direct the pursuit up the next corridor," and with that he gave me a great shove into the dark mouth of the tunnel, at the same time crying out in simulated pain and alarm as he threw himself upon the floor, as though I had felled him with a blow. From behind, the voices of the excited guardsmen came reverberating along the corridor, suddenly growing fainter as Talu's spy led them up the wrong passageway in fancied pursuit. As I ran for my life through the dark galleries beneath the palace of Silensis, all I must indeed have presented a remarkable appearance had there been any to note it, for though death loomed large about me, my face was split by a broad grin as I thought of the resourcefulness of the nameless hero of Merentina to whom I owed my life. Of such stuff are the men of my beloved Helium, and when I meet another of their kind, of whatever race or color, my heart goes out to him as it did now to my new friend who had risked his life for me simply because I wore the mate to the ring his ruler had put upon his finger. The corridor along which I ran led almost straight for a considerable distance, terminating at the foot of a spiral runway, up which I proceeded to emerge presently into a circular chamber upon the first floor of a tower. In this apartment a dozen red slaves were employed polishing or repairing the weapons of the yellow men. The walls of the room were lined with racks in which were hundreds of straight and hooked swords, javelins, and daggers. It was evidently an armory. There were but three warriors guarding the workers. My eyes took in the entire scene at a glance. Here were weapons in plenty. Here were sinewy red warriors to wield them. And here now was John Carter, Prince of Helium, in need both of weapons and warriors. As I stepped into the apartment, guards and prisoners saw me simultaneously. Close to the entrance where I stood was a rack of straight swords, and as my hand closed upon the hilt of one of them, my eyes fell upon the faces of two of the prisoners who worked side by side. One of the guards started toward me. "Who are you?" he demanded. "What do you here?" "I come for Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium, and his son, Mors Kajak," I cried, pointing to the two red prisoners, who had now sprung to their feet, wide-eyed in astonished recognition. "Rise, red men. Before we die, let us leave a memorial in the palace of Ochre's tyrant that will stand forever in the annals of Kadabra to the honor and glory of Helium," for I had seen that all the prisoners there were men of Tardos Mors' navy. Then the first guardsman was upon me, and the fight was on, but scarce did we engage ere, to my horror, I saw that the red slaves were shackled to the floor. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.